In a recent article published in the Journal of Sexual Medicine, researchers Dr. Claudia Panzer and Dr. Andre Gay questioned the role of oral contraceptives in permanently diminishing female users' sexual desire. The study's authors suggest that there is a definite link between the prolonged use of the birth control pill and sexual dysfunction in its users, mainly decreased sexual desire, arousal, decreased lubrication, and increased sexual pain. The study's researchers further noted that these side effects may actually be permanent symptoms. With this newfound information in mind, I stopped using the birth control pill. Instead, I attended a workshop with medical herbalist Saveda Jarone in Halifax, Nova Scotia, to hear about natural birth control. Presented by Planned Parenthood on January 25, 2006, this fertility awareness workshop is intended to empower women with knowledge about their own bodies. Learn to track your own fertility with Saveda Jarone here on your local campus community radio station.
Okay, so I'm Saveda. I'm a medical herbalist, and I have a practice and dispensary here in Halifax, and I'm also a fertility awareness educator. And I've been teaching these sessions here in Halifax for the past 2 years, and about the past year here at Planned Parenthood, and they've been sponsoring the workshops for us all this time, which has been fabulous, so it's been free. And they've recently had a major budget cut, so I'm working on obtaining a grant with Planned Parenthood to continue to offer this for free. Because beyond this being a method of birth control, it's also very fundamentally basic information about our bodies. And I find that about 95% of the women who I encounter in these workshops know nothing about their basic physiology. Women tend to focus their attention on menstruation, and that's what we're taught to do, but the mid-cycle fertile time is missed in our education along the way, whether it's a 20-year-old woman attending or a 60-year-old woman. So there's a major gap in reproductive health knowledge and awareness for most women out there. So what you'll be learning tonight, some of you may be familiar with it already. Otherwise, you'll be learning basically some very important essential information about your fertility cycle and how to maintain your health and your awareness of what a normal, healthy, functioning fertility cycle is, so that if you perhaps don't fit into that sort of that description of that normal fertility cycle, then you can perhaps be alerted to problems and then be proactive in taking care of your health. This fertility awareness method of birth control can be used primarily as a birth control method. So on its own, it is 99.8% effective when used properly. It does have a high failure rate when there's cheating and if it's not well understood or used properly. So you'll learn as we go through the method what cheating means and how you can reduce the effectiveness of the method. But I've been using this as a method of birth control for the past 10 years. And while I was training to become a medical herbalist, I gathered the info in all of my anatomy, physiology, and medical studies, and then applied the knowledge to my own health and gave up the birth control pill, and have been very happy successfully using this with great confidence for 10 years. So it's great. It can also be used as a secondary or sort of cooperating method with barrier methods of birth control or the IUD, other methods that, there's in the pill basically. This method also this awareness helps to tune us into a basic, deeper understanding of ourselves, our feminine psyche, and how it is intimately linked and wrapped up with all of the activity with our hormones from month to month. So by tuning in, you'll understand your moods as they relate to your fluctuating hormones, and just maybe start to understand a whole lot more about yourself with this knowledge. So it's very powerful information. Is anyone using this or been attempting to use it already? Yeah, you're using it?
Pretty much.
Okay. Pretty much.
I'm not being as technical or thorough about it because I'm actually trying to have children.
Are you trying to have children?
Not trying to have them.
Okay, and...
But I'd like to learn how to do it better so that when I do not want to have children, I can be more effective.
Yes, and that's a good point. This awareness can either help you to prevent pregnancy or to plan pregnancy and to get it right so that you're not guessing, so you know exactly when you're fertile so you can increase your chances of conceiving. Anyone else using this or half using it?
I take my temperature every day and I'm trying to find a pattern, but I haven't.
Okay.
And I can't find my cervix, so I don't know. I'm not using that part.
Okay.
I had trouble with that too.
Okay.
Couldn't do that.
Okay. We'll get into some of that then. Yeah. Anyone else?
I'm just starting.
Okay. Is anyone else also trying to get pregnant? Yeah? Anyone else is trying to prevent? Okay. Anyone using the pill and thinking of stopping the pill? Yeah?
Well, I just stopped in June.
Okay.
I stopped 4 months ago.
Okay.
I just stopped
4 months
ago.
Okay.
It takes a while for the pill to clear through your system.
It does. Yes, it does. Depending on how long you've been taking it and your general health. Yep, it can take up to 6 months. Okay. Well, we'll dig in. What we'll do is I will give you all of the background, anatomy, physiology, and the method, and then we'll spend at the end about 45 minutes actually charting a hypothetical cycle, and then we'll look at the charts together, and then hopefully you'll all leave feeling confident to go and use this method. Okay? All right. So, first of all, basic reproductive anatomy and physiology. Hopefully this diagram isn't new to any of you. You all know where your ovaries and your uterus are, and some of you know where your cervix is, your fallopian tubes. Do you know this diagram? Yeah, most people get anatomy at least when they're studying. Sure you can, yeah. So we have two ovaries sort of right there, and the fallopian tubes that lead down to the uterine area, and then the cervix opens up into the vagina, okay? And when we're born with millions of eggs in our ovaries. And when we reach puberty, those eggs then become active. And each cycle, several eggs, up to 12 or 15 eggs, will begin to grow in the ovary. And usually one, sometimes two or three, but usually one egg will then reach the peak point where it is released through ovulation. Okay. And what's happening with the hormones is that the pituitary gland, right here, between the eyes, sends messages via the hormones, luteinizing hormone and follicle stimulating hormone, to the ovary at the beginning. Well, basically, a cycle is from day one of menstruation through until the next start of menstruation. So, early on, just before we actually menstruate, at the end of the previous cycle, the hormones are very, very quiet. So early on during menstruation,
Hi, I'm sorry I'm late.
That's okay, sure.
Yeah, who are you?
Thanks.
Who are you?
And who am I?
Yeah.
Leanna. I didn't register.
Oh.
I never got an answer.
Okay.
Yeah. Is that all right?
There's a spot left.
Yep.
Yeah.
Come on in.
Thanks.
Yeah.
We're being recorded on CKDU, so we broadcast on Monday for the Women's Health Collective program, and it's anonymous, but if you happen to ask a question and would rather not be taped, then you can just let Candace know, and she'll stop it. Here are the notes.
Thanks.
Okay. As I was saying, follicle stimulating hormone is the first hormone messenger that goes down, actually tells the eggs in the ovaries to start to begin to develop. So that's the first messenger. And so the eggs begin to develop in the ovary, as I say, about 12 or 15 eggs. And then luteinizing hormone is the next hormone sent, again, from the pituitary to the ovaries. And that further stimulates the growth of those eggs in the ovaries. Okay. So as the eggs are maturing in the ovary, from pretty much day five of the cycle up until ovulation, they produce estrogen. So that is the predominant hormone during the first half of the cycle. Okay, and as we get closer and closer to the peak of that egg development, reaching ovulation, luteinizing hormone surges again, is what actually causes that last eruption of growth, an eruption from the ovary, which is ovulation, okay? So then luteinizing hormone and follicle stimulating hormone take a little break because their job is done. Luteinizing hormone does pull the cells together. It sends the message to the leftover cells in the ovary to form the corpus luteum. Okay, and that's just a collection of leftover cells that were encompassing that egg before it was released. And that corpus luteum is what produces progesterone, which is the second predominant female hormone. And that's the one that's in abundance during the second half of the cycle. Okay, so from ovulation through until the next menstruation begins. And that's the hormone that is responsible for increasing the body temperature, the basal body temperature, which is going to be one of the fertility signs that you'll be looking for. Okay, estrogen is what produces the first fertility sign, which is the cervical fluid. So as the eggs are growing and estrogen is becoming abundant in the system, this sends a message to glands near the cervix to start to produce the cervical fluid. And that cervical fluid starts out in small quantities, and the quality changes. And we'll get into all the very specifics of that in a minute, but it becomes more abundant, and the quality changes as the estrogen becomes more abundant in the system. Okay, and then if a woman hasn't conceived, then the progesterone will remain elevated right through until usually the day before menstruation begins again. And estrogen is still there, but at a lower level. And both of those hormones also help to build the uterus in case conception does occur. And then they will plummet quite low, usually the day before or the morning of menstruation. You can often tell that your period's going to start because the temperatures dip down again. And then the whole thing begins again. The hormones are quiet, menstruation occurs, and then it kicks in and the whole thing happens again. Okay?
So that ends up sort of being the first sign, isn't it, that you're pregnant when your temperature does not go back down?
Yeah. If you've missed a period and your temperatures remain elevated, then yeah, it's a very good indicator that you have conceived. That's the physiology in a nutshell. Is that pretty clear to all of you? Yeah?
Half of it.
Yeah. Okay. All right. So we'll keep going. And please ask questions or share comments as you go. Okay. So then you may have gathered from that spiel that you'll be looking for three fertility signs. The cervical fluid, which will be the sign you'll be looking out for to let you know that ovulation is approaching, that we're moving closer and closer toward ovulation. Then progesterone elevation, your basal body temperature being elevated, to confirm that ovulation did in fact occur. And then the third sign that we'll learn tonight is palpation or feeling the cervix. And that's quite hard to do on its own, to just feel the cervix and look for the subtle changes. It will move within your abdominal cavity throughout your cycle. So when you match that up with the cervical fluid and your temperature, then you can understand the subtle and notice the more subtle changes with that backup info. Yeah.
Why do some women have such an obvious understanding that they're ovulating and other women don't know? Is it our awareness of what to feel for, or is it that some women really do feel a lot more than other women?
The basic answer to that is that women haven't been taught what their fertile time is all about, what the cervical fluid means. Many women are actually aware of the cervical fluid but have no idea why it's there. They think maybe they have an infection. Most women who come to these workshops to my clinic who seem to know when they're ovulating, it's based on the pain that they get when the egg is released. And that's a secondary sign. So for those who have no knowledge of this method, the pain is what lets them know. But even that can be a bit nebulous because, you know, there could be a gastric pain going on at the same time. So it's not a reliable indicator.
So not every woman will experience that same kind of pain?
Exactly, yes, not all do. Yeah.
I've felt it, but sometimes, like, if you ovulate in the middle of the night, you're not going to notice it.
Right, it's totally unreliable, but once you are aware of where you're at in your cycle and you experience that pain, then you can actually understand that pain better. When I've ovulated, I've had pain where I've doubled over in the street. Like, it's been so intense, and unless you know what's causing it, it can be quite scary. So it is valuable to be able to link body sensations to the hormone cycle and understand them better. It relieves a lot of fear and uncertainty.
So is it fair to say that when you are taking the birth control pill, then you would have those changes in your cervical
fluid? That's right.
So you wouldn't even be aware?
No.
Because you're not ovulating, right?
No. No, all this is irrelevant while you're on the pill.
When you refer to feeling your cervix, are you meaning externally?
No, you actually would reach inside, and we'll get into that. We're going to go step by step through the three primary methods of detection. Yeah. Smoking ahead of myself here. Okay. So, some fertility facts. This isn't all about us. Men are fertile 24 hours a day most of their lives. Or in fact, we're only fertile technically. Well, let's see. The egg, once it's released, will last anywhere from 12 to 24 hours.
When you say last, what do you mean last?
Before it disintegrates. So once the egg is released from the ovary, if conception hasn't occurred, that egg will basically disintegrate and be dysfunctional and be reabsorbed into the body. And that will usually happen 12 to 24 hours after it's been released from the egg, from the ovary.
So, so then once you've gotten past that fertility, like once you're 99% sure that you've ovulated,
yes,
you get past that 2 days, then you can safely have intercourse without getting pregnant.
It's going to be more than 2 days, it's going to be 4 days, but yes, once the lovely thing about this method is once you determine your fertile time, both leading up to and post-ovulation, then you will not ovulate again until the next cycle, so therefore you don't need to use birth control to prevent pregnancy. You would certainly continue to use condoms, and you know, if you're uncertain about your partner, if you're concerned about STDs, but otherwise you cannot conceive. Pregnancy will not happen again until the next round.
So why do physicians or people tell you that you can technically get pregnant at any time during your cycle? I don't understand.
That's not true. It's absolutely not true. You can get pregnant when you ovulate, but the key point here in terms of fertility awareness is that sperm can last 3 to 5 days after they've been ejaculated inside of the woman's body in the right conditions. So that cervical fluid actually serves a purpose. It, as it becomes more fertile quality, allows the sperm to travel, like in a freeway, easily through up to meet the egg once it's been released. So as we approach ovulation, that fluid becomes more fertile, sperm can live and wait for the egg to be released. So that's why we would need to be aware of that change in cervical fluid to know to abstain, to prevent that from happening.
So basically you know roughly when you ovulate and then 5 days before you abstain.
It depends on your own cycle. It's not just simply 5 days, and we'll get into that very shortly.
That's my point I don't quite understand.
It varies from woman to woman, and we'll get into the very specific details on that. Yeah.
How long does it take to ovulate? Like, is it an instant thing? Is it a 10-minute thing? Is it a...
It's pretty much an instantaneous thing, but you may feel you may feel a dull, achy pain as the final sort of swelling of the egg occurs, as it's sort of just waiting for its last opportunity to actually break through the ovary. Mm. And then there might be a little bit of pain and congestion afterwards. Okay. But ovulation happens usually in one thrust, one burst, when it finally happens. Mm-hmm. Yeah. The reason that we can't get pregnant at any time is because the hormones are in a very delicate feedback sort of chat at all times. So what will happen is follicle stimulating hormone and luteinizing hormone will do their job, But when estrogen becomes more dominant, follicle-stimulating hormone no longer needs to stimulate those follicles because there are now, you know, a handful of eggs that are developing and producing the estrogen. So that is what causes that to settle down and quiet down. And then once ovulation has occurred, except for luteinizing hormone, which initially gathers the cells together to pump out the progesterone, again, it's no longer needed because its primary job, again, is to produce that final burst of ovulation to gather the cells together again. So they're talking back and forth at all times, so it's not possible to, when progesterone is so high and estrogen is at the level that it is, for follicle-stimulating hormone and luteinizing hormone to be activated.
Okay.
It's a very controlled cycle.
When you're going through your presentation, will you also touch on that phase in a woman's life when you're after you've given birth and you're breastfeeding and you're kind of wondering, like, when am I going to start ovulating? Because they say, oh, you don't know when you're going to ovulate.
Yeah. If we have time, I will touch on that at the end. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So the cycle. A woman's cycle can be anywhere from 23 to 35 days long. Most normal cycles are from 25 to 35 days in length. Okay, some women have, you know, a 40-day cycle or a very short 23-day cycle, and those, you know, on those either end of that extreme, that can indicate some problems. Only 15% of women actually have a 28-day cycle, the textbook length of the cycle. 15% of us have that length of the cycle. And the cycle, as I mentioned before, day one of the cycle is the first day of menstruation. And that will last, that cycle, until menstruation begins again, and that would then begin the next cycle. Okay? So it's from menstruation through until menstruation starts. That's a cycle.
That's a good question.
Yeah.
When I'm counting my menstrual days,
mm-hmm.
I count my first day as the day that bleeding starts at
yes.
any point in time, like whether it be 6 o'clock in the morning when I get up or 10 o'clock at night
yep.
when I go to bed. Is that
correct? That day. That's right.
Okay.
Yes. And so usually ovulation happens somewhere in the middle, mid-cycle. Okay. Yes.
I have a hard time determining my end time of my period.
Okay.
Because I don't know, is it just when it stops being heavy? Because I could have like a few days where there's just like some, like the brown blood that's
yep.
coming out, just like spotting.
Yeah.
But am I still technically counting that as that I'm on my period?
Oh, sure. Yes, you're still menstruating. As long as you're passing menstrual blood, you're still menstruating.
Okay.
Yes, that's not as, well, it's not as relevant in terms of when you're fertile. Menstrual blood can interfere with reading your cervical fluid. So that, like, if a woman had, you know, many, many days of menstruation, she may also begin to start producing cervical fluid early on. So that's the only time when you need to really be concerned about that.
Okay,
but
so it doesn't matter the ending.
No, the ending doesn't
okay.
isn't really relevant in terms of your fertility.
Okay,
yeah.
Thanks.
Yep. And so the cycle is divided into two halves. The pre-ovulation and the post-ovulation half. Or I've given you some other synchronized terminology. In some references, you'll read it, or it'll be referred to as the estrogenic phase or the progestational phase. So just determining which hormone is most active. The follicular phase, so when the follicles are growing in the ovary, or the luteal phase. Okay, so those are just some other names. So I'll just call it the pre-ovulation and the post-ovulation phase. Okay, so let's actually start talking about the method itself. So, go to the page where I have listed there the three primary signs of fertility. And we're going to start by talking about cervical fluid. So are you all aware of your cervical fluid already? You know it's there?
I've always understood that at the time when the woman's cervical fluid is clearest and stretchiest
yep.
is when you are most fertile.
Exactly.
You have to wait to that time.
No.
Okay.
No. If you're planning a pregnancy, you would actually time sex a few days beforehand, including that day. But you wouldn't wait just for that day. because that is the peak day of fertility, usually the day of ovulation.
So wouldn't that be the best day?
That would be the best day, but to broaden your chances, you would want to also, as your cervical fluid becomes more lubricative and more fertile, you would also
include those days.
You would include those as well.
I read that a man's sperm, like they constantly produce sperm, right?
They do, yes.
But if they ejaculate too often, it's not as
potent,
thank you,
yes.
As if they, say, ejaculated every second or third day, is that correct?
I've read that too. I guess the bottom line is there's going to be a million of them, and if you've got really good cervical fluid, or even, you know, mediocre cervical fluid, the chances they're still going to be able to do the job. Yeah.
So if you really want to get pregnant, it doesn't really matter whether you have sex every day or every second day?
Depending on the woman's cycle and the length of her cycle and what her cervical fluid is like, I often advise women in my clinic to count backwards and do it every other day, to have sex every other day, leading up to the peak fertile days. Yeah. But, men are usually pretty gotten-ho and so are those sperm, so it's, the chances are pretty good. Yeah. Even if he ejaculated every day, still be a very good chance that the sperm would do the job.
Okay. I have a question. It's difficult for me still to differentiate between the regular vaginal, whatever it's called,
yep,
and the cervical fluid.
Okay, I'm going to start from the beginning right now, and I'll talk you through the pattern of the cervical fluid, and then if there's still questions, then I'll answer them, okay? So what happens then? The beginning of the cycle, we menstruate. And after menstruation ends, and that could be anywhere from 2 to 5, even 7 days for some women, there may be a few days where there's no sensation of vaginal wetness. Dry days. There'll be some dry days. Okay. And that's followed then by what some might describe as sort of sticky days, tacky days. So there's an awareness suddenly. Relative to the dryness, there is now a sensation of moisture of some kind. And gradually, that feeling of moisture becomes more fluid. So it's no longer sticky, it becomes more fluid. It may be white, lotiony, so it becomes thinner, more fluid, leading up to the peak fertility, which is, as you described, when it becomes more clear or opaque and really stretchy. And you may notice, you know, during the day, your underwear is wet, when you have a pee and you wipe, you know, it slides really easily. You may even feel it coming out. Usually the peak cervical fluid is very, very noticeable. In fact, it's usually noticeable just when you start to tune in, when you start to look for it, know what to expect. You can just base it on how you feel, on the sensation throughout the day when you have a pee.
Like for me, when you say very stretchy, like sometimes during my peak fertile period, and I'm pretty sure I know what it is.
Yeah.
Like sometimes it'll kind of drip out of me.
Yes.
And this sounds gross, but you know, it'll be still attached to me.
Oh,
and
yes.
Dripping right down.
Oh yes,
to the,
I've had that. There's lots coming out, and if you strain, even more comes out, and you're wiping and wiping and wiping. And
okay.
Oh yes, there can be lots on your most on your really peak moment. There can be lots of it. And some women, it's horrifying. What's happening? What is this? And it can be very confusing. So, you know, they think they're having an infection. So that's normal. That's good for you. If you're trying to get pregnant, that's great.
Okay.
Yes. So what happens then? Once ovulation occurs and that abundant cervical fluid is produced, then everything can just dry up. So you'll have your peak fertile day, and the next day, you're dry. Or you may revert back to sort of a sticky sensation, and you may remain sticky or kind of tacky until you menstruate again. Sometimes I'm even a little lotiony, the cervical fluid is there, but it's the quality and the amount that you're looking for. So in terms of
your fertility and learning when to abstain. I forgot to mention at the beginning, that is one of the key ingredients to this method, if you're using it 100% without any other methods, is that when you determine your fertile time, then you abstain from having intercourse. Okay. You can certainly engage in other sexual activity and other forms of showing intimacy, but the actual intercourse must be put on hold for that window. And it's usually a 7-day window for most women. So what you're looking for then, during the first half of your cycle, is that as soon as you go from feeling dry to any sensation of moisture or wetness or stickiness, that's when you begin to abstain. So even though, you know, theoretically that sticky cervical fluid isn't really conducive to hosting sperm for 5 or 7 days, just to prevent any unwanted pregnancies, that's when you begin to abstain. Okay, and you abstain right through until post-ovulation. What you do, and this is one of the rules, it's here in your notes, is you're going to determine the peak cervical fluid day. And you only know that in hindsight. So you'll have pretty good sense on the day when it's just dripping out of you and it's egg white. This is probably my peak day. So you'll wait the next day if things have dried up or they've changed, reverted back to stickiness, then you say, okay, yes, yesterday was indeed my peak cervical fluid day. And you would indicate that on your chart somewhere, P or whatever you want. And we'll look at the chart together later. And then you'll count 4 days past that cervical fluid peak. And on the night of that 4th day, you can then continue to have intercourse again without any fear of conception, if you're trying to prevent pregnancy. And the reason that we allow so much of a buffer on the other side is to account for multiple eggs being released, because they can be released within 24 hours of each other. So you need to account for the fact that they can live for up to 24 hours. The egg can remain viable out there in fallopian tube land, waiting for a chance. So you need to account for that and allow that buffer time of 4 days. Okay.
So if we're talking sort of textbook period,
yep,
for now.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're waiting 4 days afterwards,
mm-hmm,
if you're saying here that there's roughly a 7-day window, so if you're waiting
roughly
4 days afterwards,
mm-hmm,
then obviously that means 3 days before.
Mm-hmm.
But if sperm can live for 3 to 5 days,
mm-hmm,
wouldn't you want to wait a few more days before?
Well, that depends, yes. If you, for instance, are producing cervical fluid right away, then you would abstain right away. You're not even dealing with days anymore. The days are just a guideline to sort of, so when you're just starting off with the method and wondering when can I have sex and when can't I, those numbers are there just as a gauge. You're going to bring this right down to your cycle and what's happening in your body. And that's a very key, important point. One of the general rules is the 3 or 5 day rule. So again, women may say, well, when can I have sex in the pre-ovulation phase? The 5 day rule could be there as a gauge. So on the night, any night, up until day five of your cycle, including day 5, you could consider yourself not fertile as long as you're dry. Okay.
So when you say 5 days of your cycle, you mean the first day after you bleed? After you stop bleeding, I mean?
No, during menstruation. So day 1 of the cycle is the first day of menstruation. So as a general rule, up until day 5 of the cycle, most women are generally infertile.
You said unless you're wet?
Dry.
Unless you're dry. How do you be dry while you bleed?
Well, some women only bleed 2 or 3 days.
So if you, like I normally bleed for 6 or 7 days,
So
that would mean that the first 5 days of bleeding,
mm-hmm,
I would be safe if I didn't want to have children.
Mm-hmm. Depending on how long your cycle is generally?
28 days exactly.
Okay, yeah. So you would, the first 5 days, as long as you're not noticing any, and it's hard to tell, sometimes with the menstrual blood, to sort of separate that from cervical fluid or to know.
So So between the end of bleeding
mm-hmm.
and ovulation,
mm-hmm.
that's not a safe period.
No.
None of it is
well,
safe.
Well, if you're not wanting to get pregnant,
mm.
No. If you are wanting to get pregnant, then that's a good time. Like that's fine. You don't have to worry about that. I didn't get all the bits of your question.
Well, I'm again trying to figure out when it's safe.
Yes.
Well, I want both questions answered: how to get pregnant, how not to.
Yes. Did
you
say if you're menstruating?
Yeah. If I menstruate for 7 days,
yes.
6 to 7 days,
yes.
when everything's completely leveled out, it's 7 days.
Yes.
The first 5 days of bleeding, I'm safe.
Uh-huh.
But then between that day five
yes.
and ovulation,
yes.
none of that is ever safe.
No.
Okay.
No. Unless a woman has a long cycle, like a 35-day cycle, she may menstruate for 5 or 7 days and finish menstruation and have a day or two of dryness. And for that woman, she could honor the dry day rule. And that's the second rule that you can be aware of. On the night of a dry day, you are not fertile and you can have intercourse. Sperm aren't going anywhere in a dry environment. They'll just sort of get stuck and they'll die quickly. Okay? So on the night of a dry day, you're not fertile, so you can have intercourse. And on the night of the fifth day, providing there's no cervical fluid being produced. Women who have a short cycle, a 25-day or shorter cycle, you would have to consider a 3-day rule that typically, you know, the first 3 days of the cycle are non-fertile.
So some women may not have a dry period.
Some women may not. Some women
until
may.
Until after ovulation.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Some women actually go from menstruation right to a sensation of stickiness, tackiness. So for those women, depending on other particulars in the cycle and the length of their cycle and how consistent that pattern is, that may be considered an infertile day, and they would actually look for a change, a variation from that sticky tackiness when that actually then becomes lotiony or wet.
Okay.
Yeah, because sperm aren't going very far either in that sticky tacky, so it depends on the rest of your cycle and how standard that pattern is.
Okay.
Yeah.
I hope these other aspects become a little more reassuring, because this just sounds too chancy. I'm already getting anxious.
Are you?
Like, you're saying could be 5 days, maybe 3, and that's...
Yeah. Well, and that's just it. We're all different, and our bodies are all different, but based on our reproductive health and our general health. So it's different for each one of us, and that's the beauty of this method. Unfortunately, fertility clinics, medical clinics, are lumping us all together and expecting us to all be the same and handing out misinformation. So they're telling women to have intercourse on day 14 of their cycle if they want to get pregnant. And a woman who has a 25-day cycle, she's fertile on day 10 or 11 of her cycle, and she's trying in frustration for years and never conceiving. Or a woman has a 35-day cycle, and she's ovulating around day 17 or day 18. And again, she's trying for years and years, frustrated. So the fact that this is tailored to each woman is very significant and very important. And yes, it will become maybe more clear as you get through the rest of the information. And it takes a little time to learn. If you're not used to paying attention to your body so closely, with this newfound awareness, it'll become more obvious and more clear, but it can take several cycles to, first of all, identify the cervical fluid, and then to begin to see the patterns and understand what that means. So you have to give yourself a little time to absorb it, go away from this workshop, start charting, maybe get the books, and be patient and allow yourself, you know, even 3 to 6 cycles. Using this if you wish to use it as a primary method of birth control to let it sink in. So it takes a little time, but it's not as hard as it may seem, and very often women are a little overwhelmed hearing all this information and feeling the responsibility of it all, when in fact it's just such a natural thing. And once we tune into it and tune into our body and chart it and pull all the pieces together, it's actually quite easy to learn. Any woman can learn it. Yeah. Okay. So the cervical fluid, you're wondering how to determine the quality to sort of like with arousal fluid. Often women wonder the difference. How do you know the difference? So Have I answered your question, or is there more to it?
No, I'm still not clear. Because if it's clear,
yep.
I still can't tell. Like, when there's white or off-white, that's mm-hmm. very understandable to me, what I'm looking at.
Okay.
But if it's clear,
yep.
I don't quite know if it's the regular vaginal fluid or if it's the cervical fluid. I thought those were two different things.
Okay, well, vaginal fluid,
and the one I understood dries up very quickly,
mm-hmm.
and the other one...
Yes, so arousal fluid, for instance, when you're sexually aroused, that will dry up quickly and disappear. Mm-hmm. It'll dissipate. Cervical fluid doesn't go away so easily, especially the egg white cervical fluid. Like, you can be playing with it and trying to wipe it off for a while, and just, like, it won't come off. Same thing with sort of the lotion-y and other types of cervical fluid. You have to sort of wipe it off. You have to wash your hands and get rid of it. It stays around longer. Or other, like, vaginal fluid, like arousal fluid, will disappear quickly. The other fluids that can get confused are infection fluids. If you have a vaginal infection or a candida infection, this will be accompanied by other symptoms. So soreness, burning, pain, fever, itching, or a foul odor. And that will, depending on the type of infection, if it's a candida or a yeast infection, it'll be sort of white and clumpy. If you're having another sort of mild infection, it might be clear or blood tinged or brown, have brown streaks through it, or even brown or blood, and that's more of an indicator of infection, and that usually, as I say, coincides with other symptoms. So it's definitely something to be aware of if you're prone to getting vaginal infections, to understand the difference between that and cervical fluid. And once you now know what to look for with cervical fluid, you can determine. And if you are having an infection and your cervical fluid reading is unclear or confused, then you would abstain completely. And most women who are having an infection don't want to have sex anyway, because it would be painful, or you could pass it along. So in that case, you would abstain when you have an infection, because it would cloud your ability to gauge that. Okay. Yeah.
Just one more clarifying question.
Yep.
I thought I understood. I'm sure I understand which is the peak fertility cervical fluid. That's
uh-huh.
the egg white stuff. I know that one.
Yep.
But now I'm a little bit confused about the fluid that basically stains your underwear. That
mm-hmm.
yellowish.
Yep.
You know, it sticks to
yes,
your underwear kind
yes,
of thing.
Yes.
Is that cervical or vaginal?
That's cervical fluid.
Oh, that
well,
is.
it could be vaginal fluid if you're having an infection, but you'll know the difference. But yes, cervical fluid will stain the underwear.
Okay.
And that's
so is that the sticky stuff or
that's
the dry
usually
stuff?
Well, when it's dry, there's nothing. Yes.
Okay. All right.
Yeah, and that's another way. A little further in your notes, you'll have a sheet on making good cervical fluid observations. So these are all just hints, things that you can do. Looking at your underwear, or when you go and have a pee, and you would note the sensation when you wipe, you know, how easily the toilet paper glides, or the appearance on the toilet paper as well. And it's good to get into the habit of wiping before you pee and after you pee, just so you can have a good look before you pee. So you can read through that and have a look. I've broken the sensation down into dry or smooth or lubricative, which is the peak. And then you've got some appearance. So you've got the colors and what they may indicate. So you can read through that on your own, actually, and use it as a guide. The other thing that can interfere with your cervical fluid readings is semen. So if you're not using condoms, if you're in a committed relationship and you know that there's no chance of passing STDs, then you would want to practice doing Kegel exercises after intercourse. Do you guys all know how to do Kegels? Yeah? Kegels there's a grouping of muscles in the pelvic cavity. So when you have a pee and you stop the flow, you tighten those muscles, and you relax them, that's a Kegel. You're doing a Kegel exercise. You're tightening those muscles and relaxing them. So you can tighten them and relax them and do that several times after having intercourse to expel the semen. So if you go and have a pee afterwards and do, you know, about 12 or 15 rounds of Kegels, then you'll get rid of a lot of those sexual fluids.
So there is some truth to, if you're trying to get pregnant,
yes,
after intercourse, then
yes,
lay down, stay still.
Yeah, don't go have a pee, because that straining in itself will expel some
really?
Of that fluid. Yeah. So infection and sexual fluids. Those are just some other fluids to be aware of. Getting to know your own. So that's the cervical fluid part. Is that starting to make a little more sense or sink in? Is it pretty clear? Yeah? Okay. We'll leave that for now. And we'll move on to the second major sign of fertility. And that's the temperature, the basal body temperature. Okay? And that's actually the sign that tells you you have in fact ovulated. So the pattern typically from pretty much the day before you menstruate, so the last day of the previous cycle, but we'll keep it at this cycle for now, during menstruation and all the days leading up to the day of ovulation, the basal body temperature is low. And the basal body temperature is your temperature when your body is at rest. Okay? And as soon as you ovulate, the temperature doesn't go up, not right away. It may take a day or two for the luteinizing hormone to gather all of the cells back together to form the corpus luteum. And then that's when you'll notice the progesterone, the temperature will become elevated. So you may note when you ovulate, and you will probably not notice the actual temperature going up for a day or two later. And that's pretty normal, depending on how responsive your body is to progesterone and how abundantly you produce progesterone. How much luteinizing hormone you have in your system, all of those factors will dictate how soon you notice the rise in temperature. Okay, so you take the temperature first thing in the morning. So whereas with the cervical fluid, you would note that at the end of the day, so after you have a full day of being upright and gravity is pulling the cervical fluid down, you would note that at nighttime, after a day of observation, you would record your temperature first thing in the morning. Need to get a special basal body thermometer temperature, as opposed to a fever thermometer. Yeah. Basal body thermometers are much more delicate and will note finer increments of elevation, whereas fever thermometers are usually more crude. And you can get digital or mercury basal body thermometers. At most pharmacies, they're about $15. The only expense you'll have with this method of birth control.
You take your temperature under your tongue?
Doesn't matter. You can take it anywhere you want, as long as you take it in the same spot every day. So rectally under the arm, vaginally under the tongue. It's usually just easier to reach over and pop it in your mouth, I find. But you can use it wherever you want.
That was one thing I was concerned about, this method, because I think I told you I know of someone who was teaching this method many years ago,
yeah.
And she was saying you had to do this vaginally, take your...
Right.
Temperature, and I was thinking, how are you going to do that with children and
yes.
family and work? I know that it's not that much different than putting it in your mouth, but you can walk around with it in your mouth.
Oh.
And you can do it with your kids in the bed.
Uh-huh.
You know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So yeah, it doesn't matter where you take your temperatures. The digitals are really quick.
Mm-hmm.
You can get a reading within usually 30 seconds. The key, though, with basal body temperature is your temperature when your body's at rest, so you need to have 3 consecutive hours of sleep before you take your temperature. So if you're waking up every morning at 7, that's fine. If your alarm is set for 7 and you've woken up at 5 to go pee, then you would actually take your temperature at 5 instead of at 7, because you only get the 2 hours of sleep. That is providing you had 3 hours of sleep leading up to the 5 o'clock. So, yeah.
So is the number of hours of sleep beforehand more important than the actual time?
Yes.
The reason I ask that is because I'm still nursing.
That's
what I was just saying. So I'm bopping up and down, and I never know when I'm going to be woke up. It could be 3 o'clock in the morning, it could be 4, it could be 6. Mm-hmm.
So yes, the 3 hours of sleep is very important so that your body establishes that rest state again, so you get an accurate basal body temperature. There is value in routine. It is valuable to try and take your temperature at the same time every morning if your life is conducive to that. If for some reason there are variations from time to time, you would note those, you understand them, because the temperature may be naturally be lower during the wee hours, the early morning hours when you're asleep. And when you sleep in, say if you sleep in some morning until 8 or 9, then that temperature reading will be a little higher. So yes, the time of day does matter to a certain extent, but not as greatly as getting the 3 hours. And so if you break from your normal pattern for any reason, you will just note that on your chart, and that way, you, when you look back, you'll at least be able to explain why on that day the temperature was, you know, 0.2 degrees Celsius higher than the others. It stood out.
So if, say, if my baby wakes me up at 4 o'clock in the morning
mm-hmm.
for nursing,
mm-hmm.
and I'm laying there and he's
mm-hmm.
squirming, and I'm thinking, okay, got to take my temperature now because
yes.
there's going to be no more 3 hours of sleep.
Yes.
Do I take it immediately, or do I wait till I flipped over and got him nursing it?
Take it immediately.
Before I move.
And that's just it. You want to keep it close by because any movements will begin to rise, the temperature will begin to rise. So before you even get out of bed to pee in the morning, you want to take your temperature.
So what would be more important for if you don't get to consecutive hours of sleep ever?
And then,
yeah.
That's not a joke, sadly, in my life.
I'm sorry.
I'm sorry.
Please be sorry.
Yes.
I have 3 children. But what would be, so in this situation, what would be the best time to
mm-hmm.
take the temperature?
Yeah, okay, when you say, are you getting up every 2 hours out of bed?
Either getting up, or if I haven't actually gotten up the 5th time and just kept them in my bed, I'm doing what she's talking about, shifting over, rolling over,
okay.
sorting out to nurse
yeah.
the baby back to sleep. So
okay.
Not ever lying still for 3 hours
mm-hmm.
or 2.
Okay, well,
so what would be ideal?
A
the same time every day?
Yes.
That's what I'm wondering. So
in that case?
Say every, for sure by 6 o'clock I'm up every single, I'm awake every day.
Okay.
So 6 o'clock?
Yeah, you could aim for 6, and if you were woken up at, if you had 2 hours, from 3 to 5, and you knew you had to get up at 6, there'd only be another hour,
right.
take it at 5 on that day,
right.
but in
okay.
general, aim for 6 o'clock.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, and what you could do is, after a few cycles of charting, you'll get to see how much your temperature will change depending on certain things. Some women's bodies are more sensitive to progesterone, or their temperature may be more sensitive in general to what's going on around them. So for instance, if you stay up later the night before, if you drink a lot of alcohol the night before, if you eat late at night the night before, if you're severely stressed for a few days and that day, if you've traveled, if you're sick, all of those things will affect your temperature. Although some women's systems don't register that through their body temperature, whereas others do. So those slight interruptions, your body may be accommodating that. And
right, that's what I'm wondering if it's just
so
used to.
So you may not even see much variation. And yes, during the cycle, the temperature may go up a little bit, by 0.2 or 3 of a degree each day. You know, that may also happen in the second half, the elevated half. It may go up and down, up and down, up and down. That's normal. It's when you've done something of the ordinary, like drink lots or eat lots the night before, like really late, that you might see a spike. And so you'll just put a note beside that and explain why.
So would those things affect your actual cycle? Traveling probably would.
Yeah.
So that would change
your fertility.
It would, yeah.
That situation.
It
but
absolutely.
What else?
Okay,
like
yes.
Major, like you talked about stress, for instance.
Yes, yes. The hypothalamus is part of the brain that is collecting data constantly about our internal and external environment. And it's very sensitive, gathering info, depending on how, you know, how stressed we are. It's sending out messages based on that. It's picking up whether we've traveled, how much we've eaten, and how our body feels. All of those messages it's picking up, and it actually dictates what the pituitary gland does, in fact. So it can cause the body to actually ovulate sooner or later than normal in a cycle.
But would you still have the same... changes in that
yep,
situation?
Yeah, yeah, it's all the same things would happen, but you know, if you typically ovulate on day 12 of your cycle, if there have been circumstances that have been, you know, unusual that month, then the body may choose to hold off and not ovulate until a few days later on, until it feels and everything feels right.
Mm-hmm.
Or in some circumstances, it actually may cause your body, you may ovulate sooner.
Right.
And that's why the rhythm method fails. Okay, the rhythm method is trash because it is based on calculating the length of previous cycles and finding an average, and that's then your fertile day, the average middle point. And as I just explained, sometimes even if you have regular cycles, you may be surprised one month and actually ovulate a day or two early. Or a couple days later, for whatever reason. So that method fails often, and it's often confused with fertility awareness method. It's the calendar method or the rhythm method, and that's why often other medical professionals will discount the value of fertility awareness method, because they actually don't know the difference, and they confuse FAM with rhythm. So it's a terrible mistake.
So this is not the rhythm
method? No. Rhythm method is just, again, calculating an average fertile day based on the length of cycles and counting backwards.
I just have a question about the 3 consecutive hours of sleep. So is it more the fact that you're moving around than you're actually sleeping? So if you sort of wake up,
mm-hmm.
but you're sort of stirring, like you know that you're awake because you can see the clock.
Yes.
But you haven't moved around.
That's fine.
Okay.
Go back to sleep. Yeah. Take it at your normal time when you expect to get up. No, it's only when you've been active. So if you have a baby in bed and yes, you're feeding, or if you've gotten out of bed for whatever reason, even if it's been like a quick pee to the bathroom back. So yeah, if you're just sort of just aware but not up but not moving, it's fine.
That's why my temperature went like this all the time.
Yes, yeah, yeah. It's easier to use this method when you have a relatively normal sort of routine or reliable routine. It makes it easier. It doesn't mean that it's impossible to use the method when you don't have routine. I mean, you've got shift workers, God bless them, who are trying to use this method too, and it still can be done. It just needs to be tailored to their life and worked on, and for some it's easier than others. There are obstacles using this method when there are hormone irregularities and reproductive health problems like fibroids, endometriosis, polycystic ovarian syndrome, other types of hormonal irregularity, then those need to be corrected first before this method can be used successfully. So it's helpful to have some routine and to note when anything deviates from your normal routine. Just note that when you're charting. So you take your temperature first thing in the morning, keep it by your bed, and chart it first thing in the morning. I think I've said everything I need to say right now about the temperature. So in terms of charting, on the third consecutive night of high temperatures, you can start to have intercourse again. So it's the other rule. You cannot use the cervical fluid sign alone, and you certainly can't use the temperature sign alone. So what you need to do is, you'll be noticing your temperatures as you go along. You'll see your peak fertile day with your cervical fluid, and you're gonna expect that your temperature's gonna go up the next morning, probably, or the morning after that. So you want to have 3 consecutive elevated temperatures. And so on the night of that third elevated temperature, then you can have intercourse. And that usually lines up with the 4th day rule with the cervical fluid, when you count your 4 days past the peak. And you're going to be comparing those elevated temperatures to the temperatures before ovulation. When I give you the charts, you're going to see how to do that. You're going to draw what's called a cover line, and you're going to separate the low pre-ovulation temperatures from the higher post-ovulation temperatures, so it's really easy and clear to see when it went up. And it has to stay up.
You have been listening to a fertility awareness workshop presented by Saveda Jerome and Planned Parenthood on the Women's Collective program, produced by the CKDU Women's Collective in Halifax, Nova Scotia. For more information about the CKDU Women's Collective, to find out more, to get involved, that sort of thing, you can email Candace Morris, the spoken word coordinator, at swc@ckdu.ca. That's swc@ckdu.ca. Also, feel free to check out our website at www.ckdu.ca. That's www.ckdu.ca. Thanks for listening.